She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And remember our tagline, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And hopefully every show you've ever listened to left you with something to think about. This show is sponsored by the Fairfax Companies, a leader in the business of sustainability. We thank them sincerely for their ongoing support, and they know it, and all of my regular listeners know it too. An amazing company. So get ready for another informative show about a topic that is impacting all of our lives, whether we're aware of it or not, and that's the situation with bees and other pollinators. We are going to let facts get in the way on this show, and I love when that happens. So thank you, everybody out there who contacted me asking me to actually cover this topic. I'm personally very much looking forward to this interview, as I do with many interviews. Our guest is Lori Davies Adams, and she is the executive director of the Pollinator Partnership, the largest organization in the world dedicated exclusively to the protection and promotion of pollinators and their ecosystems. Lori, thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to be a part of Mrs. Green's World.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Mrs. Green, and with your wonderful listeners who I know care a lot about this issue, and as well they should.
They do. They really do care. They're an engaged audience, and I thank them every day. So let's start with the big, you have a big mission of the Pollinator Partnership, and then we can get down to some of my questions that I hope will clear up a lot of misinformation that's out there.
Well, for the last nearly two decades, the Pollinator Partnership has worked to raise the profile of pollinators, which are kind of the little guys behind the scenes for one out of every third bite of food that most people in this country eat, and they're responsible for about $40 billion worth of products and services across the country. But what's interesting about pollinators, and they include not just bees and not just honeybees, but about 20,000 species of bees worldwide. They also include butterflies, beetles, birds, some mosquitoes, a fly that really is ubiquitous across pollination. So there are a lot of really unsuspecting helpers that are bringing food to our table, but they're also bringing food to other wildlife, and they're keeping our ecosystems sound and healthy. So they really deserve our attention, and for a long time, we really haven't paid that much attention. But between 65 and 80% of all the flowering plants on Earth require these animal visits in order to set seed and to reproduce.
Now, the big shocker in there, in those list of things that you mentioned to me, I cannot believe it was mosquitoes. That was, of all the things you said, it's like,
it's
wow.
Not every. Now, I have to say, we don't lead with mosquitoes. It's hard, very hard to get people excited about that. No, it's not all mosquitoes. It's just one male mosquito from one species of mosquito, but the fact is there are a whole lot of things out in the world that are working on your behalf that may not have crossed your mind that, in fact, they're actually helping. A lot of mosquitoes are just pests, and we could, in fact, probably live without them. However, they're great food for bats, and they're great food for birds. So the fact is this is all a network. It's all connected, and everything that we do has a consequence and a repercussion, and we need to be very thoughtful about how we use our resources and actually how we spend our time and what we put our attention to.
And it's funny because I think it'll, when I say we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to, I might think twice about smashing the next mosquito that lands on me and think this could be a pollinator, so just deal with it. Anyway, you mentioned one thing quickly in passing, and I think it's huge, and it's part of the facts that really do matter, one out of every three bite of food comes to us because of the action, the activity of pollinators. Why do they matter so much in other ways? I know there's the significant part of the food chain, but what are some other, you know, pieces of it that we need to be aware of as the general public?
Well, just to stay on the food chain for a minute, the foods in particular that are brought to you by pollinators are very, very nutritious, helpful foods in our diet. And they're not the grains, they're not the grasses. Those are really the kind of bulk that we use for our carbohydrates. But if you look at the foods that are really high in nutrient value, that bring us our vitamins, that bring us our antioxidants, the nuts and fruits and vegetables, berries, the kinds of even nuts that we now know are extremely helpful for us, but also chocolate we're now seeing has these very helpful properties.
Right.
These are all brought to us, lycopene in tomatoes. These are all brought to us by pollinated plants. And so the interaction between the animal and the plant is really a critical part of our well-being. So it's a great connector for conservation because people get excited about what they eat, what they drink. That's a real connection for them. And the other exciting thing about pollinator work is when you actually do work to help them, you're going to see a result. If you put plants in the ground that are really specifically designed for pollinators, you're going to see hummingbirds show up. You're going to see butterflies show up. You're going to see bees. And these are the kinds of actions that can even draw people further into conservation because they suddenly are remembering how important nature is to them. And they're, in many ways, reliving some of the things that didn't happen unless they were young, when they took time to look for a butterfly in a garden or they took time to explore nature. And we're all pretty busy right now. So it's really important to slow down and pay attention to this. And actually, unlike many conservation issues, you may never see the whale that you've saved or the wolf that you've saved, but you will see the pollinator and your garden will also see the benefits.
And who doesn't stop? Even, you know, we were on vacation with my grandchildren, and I think everybody takes a pause if a butterfly comes anywhere near them. It's one of the things that we notice because there's the magic of, you know, the butterfly magic. But going back to, is there, you know, you said over 20 years of work. Why is it now, in my opinion, becoming so topical? What is there a single issue? What is going on with the pollinators? And why has it become increasingly, but maybe not enough, newsworthy? Sometimes it's like, yeah, we want to hear the news, but we want to hear the truth in the news. So what is issue?
It's interesting because in the 20th century, there were at least three major bee die-offs that didn't get any attention at all. And so why now in the 21st century?
Right.
Why would we really be starting to pay attention to that? Well, I think, obviously, we think that 20 years of work that we and others have put in on this have raised the profile. One of the things we first did back in about 2003 was form a committee to try to get the National Academies of Science to put out an NRC study on the status of pollinators in North America. And once that came out, and it was released in, I believe, 2006, it was released at one of our meetings at the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign, which we run. That really was the start of raising the importance of this issue. Over 300 stories were all around the globe about something that people had pretty much taken for granted. Immediately after that study was released, there was a major bee kill that started in, at least the attention started in Pennsylvania with Dave Hackenberg, a beekeeper who raised the flag and said, there's something happening with my bees. And that was the start of the colony collapse disorder, which, again, could have been relegated to the back pages of whatever newspaper would pick it up. But instead, there was already sort of a building vortex of attention that said, wait a minute, this actually is something that we all rely on. We better pay attention to it. And then when colony collapse disorder came in, which was devastating, a third of the bees in the United States dying under very mysterious circumstances. Bees die on a pretty regular basis, just as the normal process of the hive and the colony. But to have them die with a healthy queen, with good stores within the hive, capped brood, ostensibly looking like a very healthy hive, and suddenly the adult bees just leave. They just vacate the hive. And in a normal bee kill, the bees that are dead hang around the hive. They're littered around the bottom of the hive, or they're being carried out by the healthy bees. They were just gone. And it was such an unusual circumstance, and it was so devastating for this particular beekeeper, and the buzz, if you will, began to build about, was this happening elsewhere? And it was, and it got the attention that it needed from Congress and from the United States government, but it still is a rather mysterious phenomenon. And frankly, the overwintering deaths, which triggered this, those numbers are a little bit better right now. It's kind of been an up and down cycle. But as of last year, we're at about 24% of the bees died. Now, that's still unacceptable.
Alarming,
that's still unsustainable. It's still alarming, but it's a better trend. And there are multiple factors that are figuring into this. And I think it's always interesting that when people think about bee disease or bee health, they think, what's the answer? They want one answer. Whereas with human diseases, we're perfectly willing to say, well, we don't expect an easy, quick answer for...
Right, it's complicated.
For something. We say there must be a lot of factors. Well, in this, what the USDA and EPA have determined is that there are, it's a very complex issue, and that there are a sort of a series of factors that have contributed to really a diminishment of bee health, of honeybee health in the United States. And it's interesting because honeybees are the ones that we concentrate on because we see them.
Right.
We have beekeepers who actually manage these hives. They take them to different pollination service contracts that they have, or they manage them in their backyard. They're paying a lot of attention to them. But there are almost 4,000 other species of bees in the United States that don't get as much attention. They're harder to see. Their nesting and their foraging behaviors are quite different. And so there hasn't been the money, there hasn't been the resources to have baseline data to really know how healthy they are. But we know that they're hard at work in the wild areas. They're really taking care of those meadows that we all enjoy when we go hiking or we go bird watching. They're keeping the songbirds healthy by providing not just berries that are available for food, but also a lot of songbirds eat pollinators. So it's all part of the same cycle, but we're only getting really the tip of the information when we deal just with honeybees. They are the champions in agriculture right now. They are the bee that we rely on the most for our agricultural pollination. But we also rely on bumblebees and alfalfa leafcutter bees. There are a lot of bees that are actually contributing as a regular working part of the United States agriculture.
And is there a part of this that, just going off a little bit, is there a part of this, I think about what you said, you know, you can plant a garden or you can plant just a couple of really pretty plants in your front yard or your backyard or your apartment patio. Is there habitat devastation at all, a part of this disappearing habitat? I don't want to call it devastation, but there's so much expansion of, you know, those meadows you talked about that are becoming buildings. Is that one of the factors that contributes to the disappearing or the impact on the pollinators?
Absolutely. That's definitely, I would say, the top driver. The loss of habitat is identified, and it was identified by the National Academy of Sciences NRC study as the number one problem. And if you think about it, if you look at all the little places where we live, as humans, real estate is an issue. We're looking for space as well. Within our cities and suburbs, we've taken away a lot of the scruffy little patches, the empty lots, the kinds of places that would breed insect life and beneficial insect life. They've kind of disappeared. We also have favored ornamentals in our plantings. So we have lost, through hybridization, some of the proteins and the carbohydrates that come to insects through nectar and pollen.
Right.
So we have done a lot of things in terms of the human impact on this situation. But that means that there is a lot that we can also do to undo that situation. And you mentioned planting. It can be anything from a flower box, a patio, a backyard, a 17,000-acre ranch, a school, a corporate headquarters, a rooftop, a temple, a church, a synagogue. There are real estate possibilities everywhere for pollinators, and we encourage everybody to say, I'm going to share. You don't have to give us your whole golf course or your whole lawn or your whole corporate campus, but SHARE. And that is an acronym we use for Simply Have Areas Reserved for the Environment. Just take a portion and share it. And what you're doing is building your real neighborhood. That's where you really live. You live in an ecosystem. It's not a political boundary. It's your neighborhood. And this is how you enhance all the other creatures that live in your neighborhood.
And, you know, we just did something as simple as put up a finch feeder outside of my office window. And we have really, you know, plants on the front porch, even in Arizona, and they're still alive. It's like our hibiscus is still blooming. I don't know how. But it creates, I want to say, joy. It's so affirming to be walking by and see a little hummingbird that is, you know, stop to get some nectar, and the finches attract, you know, the quail that attract the dove that are attracting everything else. I mean, it's pretty amazing if you do one little thing, like put in a bird feeder or plant some things. It's such an easy, simple solution. And, you know,
well, yeah, no, I was going to say here in San Francisco, where that's where our headquarters is, but we have offices all around. In Chinatown, we had a space that only had room for 3 barrels. That's all the space that they had,
right.
And we put in pollinator plants. And I have a picture of a young man pointing to the first butterfly he's ever seen from those 3 little barrels.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. I love it. See, that's the human factor that appeals to everybody. Why is it, though, I'm still a little bit like, are bees the number one pollinator that have the biggest impact? Because, like you mentioned, so many others. Are there others that are equally as important, or, you know, 1, 2, and 3 that we should be concerned about or that you're looking at?
Well, most of the things that you can do, the plants that you can put in, the behaviors that you can institute, are going to help all of them.
Right.
But the fact is, I would say it's hard to beat a bee, because most bees have a lot of hair on their bodies. They're going to pick up the pollen. And as you probably know, with Apis mellifera, the honeybee, they even have a little crop, a sack that they put the pollen in to carry it back to the hive. So they're going to be moving a lot of the pollen around, and not everything that visits a flower actually is pollinating it. Sometimes they're robbing the nectar or robbing the pollen. So it's a very complex system that does 2 things. It moves the pollen within the flower from the male part to the female part, exactly the kind of thing that the flower can't do for itself. But it also mixes the pollen, so it takes it from one flower to the next, so that genetic diversity is increased. So it's doing a lot of things. Some insects do it better than others, and some bees do it better than others four particular plants. And if you think about the way the plant is shaped, the flower, whether it's a trumpet flower or a flat flower, it'll have either a landing spot. It may have that anther very deep within the flower, which requires a long tongue. But they're getting a floral reward. The pollinators aren't doing this just to help us or help the plant. They're actually going after the nectar and the carbohydrates that they're getting from that.
Hold that
and
thought.
The pollen.
We're going to take a quick break, everybody. I'm sure you're joining me and hanging on our every word, Lori Davies Adams, when we come back from the Pollinator Partnership. Please stay here with me. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine, it's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines, it gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit chapmantucson.com.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love, Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange, sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear, now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Ready to clean out that garage? Goodwill offers you 40 convenient locations all over southern Arizona. And at every one, you'll be greeted by a uniformed Goodwill employee trained to assist you in unloading your items, prepared to offer you a receipt for your tax-deductible donation, and grateful for something you won't get anywhere else.
Thank you. Because of your donation, I have a job.
The gift of Goodwill. For a list of Goodwill donation sites, go to goodwillsouthernaz.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And we are certainly getting lots to think about from our guest today. Her name is Lori Davies Adams, and she is the executive director of the Pollinator Partnership, the largest organization in the world dedicated exclusively to the protection and promotion of pollinators and their ecosystems. And a little bit more about Lori. She has overseen the initial organization and the development of the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign, the 120-plus member collaboration of stakeholders from Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. that work for a variety of fields, including science, the environment, agriculture, and private industry. Quite a big operation to lead. And Lori, again, thank you for being with us. And can we just segue for a minute? Another topic near and dear to my heart is we have read recently in the past year or so about the monarch butterflies. Does this fall into the conversation? I mean, it is a devastating thing to read about. But what about the butterflies, the monarch butterflies?
Well, I think they're a very important part of the picture, and I agree. It's been devastating to watch the overwintering numbers out of Mexico and to see how very, very far the migration has fallen. And the migration, as you probably know, is literally one of the treasures of North America, and it unites all the countries of North America. Canada, Mexico, and the United States are all involved in this absolutely miraculous journey that happens from these overwintering sites all the way north to Canada and then reverses itself for the wintering season. So this is something that we want all of us to maintain on our watch. We really don't want to see this migration go away. And there are a number of factors that have to be really put into play immediately in order to prevent the migration from disappearing. We're part of something called the Monarch Joint Venture. A number of organizations are a part of this. It is a group that works to really ensure that a very strategic plan is followed to allow there to be the resources on the migratory path that goes from Canada all the way through. There's three different migrations, a couple that are east of the Rockies and one that's west of the Rockies. But these kinds of movements, major migrations, are supported by the nectaring plants that are available along the route. And we encourage people to go on our website, pollinator.org. We have incredible information on what you can plant to support the monarch butterfly. And obviously, the one important element is the milkweed, because this is the only plant that the monarch butterfly will lay its eggs on, because once these eggs hatch, those beautiful black and yellow striped caterpillar have to have that milkweed in order to grow and to form the chrysalis. So it's part of our heritage. It's something we can do something about, and we need to have these monarch way stations, is the way Monarch Watch calls them. There are a number of wonderful organizations, but Monarch Watch is one of them. They say put these way stations in place and provide the nutrients that are really needed for each generation to make this journey. Obviously, there are problems in Mexico, but I think the Mexican government's working hard to ensure that the overwintering forests are available for these butterflies. The same thing on the Pacific migration in Pacific Grove here in California. People are working really hard to make sure that once the butterflies get to their overwintering grounds, they are safe and they have plentiful food. But it's up to all of us to make sure that that pathway, that highway, is supplied with the nectar and host plants that they need.
Milkweed. And, you know, I could wax poetic about your website. It's like someone like Mrs. Green salivates over the content richness of it. But I want to really put a little emphasis on that now, and at the end of the show, a shout out, because it's so user-friendly that you can literally put in your zip code, find out about your eco-region, and they will help you. It guides you to literally select the plants that are specific to your area. I mean, how great is that? I thought of several other Facebook pages that I really connect with on a regular basis, where I will post about the show and post about this information. I mean, it's pollinator-friendly planting guides. Who cannot love that?
Well, our website, Pollinator, and it's singular, P-O-L-L-I-N, pollinator.org, has over 1,000 pages. So you could be in there for a long time.
Go down the rabbit hole.
But,
no kidding.
As you say, we don't expect people to know what ecoregion they live in. We know they know what zip code they live in, so we ask them to put in their zip code, and up pops a 30-page brochure that will tell them about their neighborhood. As I mentioned before, it's not a political boundary that you live in. You live in an eco-region, but you probably don't know much about it. This will tell you everything about where you live and all the natural features of your neighborhood. Then it will tell you what plants to plant, what they will attract, and also it'll tell you step by step what you need to do. But if you're not interested in that, you can use our app. We have the same information on the
There's an app for that. I saw that too.
I know there's an app
there's
for that.
There's an app for
but
that.
It's a free app. It's called the Be Smart Gardener app, and it will even help you if you want to put in your zip code and you say, I only want yellow flowers, I only want butterflies, and I'm in a shady spot. You can sort for those things. So it's a very helpful tool, and like everything we do, we make it available because these are the recipes for success. Everybody taking one step forward, and everybody has a landscape that they can influence, their school, their workplace, their place of worship. These are the places that you can start building pollinator gardens. And as you said, habitat loss is the number one, but it's also for the bees in particular. They need nutrition, so these have to be nutritious plants, and we tell you what you need for that. They're facing pathogens. They're facing parasites. So we're trying to help prevent invasive species from taking hold. But in addition, we're trying to make sure that pesticide use and the impacts of pesticides are reduced or eliminated. we know that there are occasions when people have to use a pesticide, but we ask that you first take a look at your alternatives. First, make sure that you have something that warrants some sort of intervention. If you have to do something, there are good products that you can pick. There are good methods to apply things. There are times of day. There are weathers that you have to pay attention. These are powerful tools. And what we haven't done in the past is acknowledge that this is something that has to be done with a great deal of responsibility. And we're not talking just about agriculture. We're talking about everyday people who have to be very, very careful about what they apply to the living matter around them. So we're not advocating against. We're advocating for being smart.
And it's you know, when you're talking about it, there are so many issues that I cover on the show where I think, how much can we do? Is there a piece of this that the public, the call to action? But in this particular case, everybody can do something. I mean, we have a great project at the library down here in Tucson, and there all of the trees that are planted outside, they're planting vegetables around the trees and flowers around the trees to just create more habitat, and it's helping to feed the homeless. Like, I'm so not kidding. They're allowed to go there and take the squash and take the... So it's like, when you talk about a sustainable community, that's exactly what you're talking about.
Well, and I think it's hard sometimes for people to recognize that they do have the opportunity to do this.
To make a difference.
And that, yeah, and they really will make a difference. Frankly, people care about bees, and they may care about them more than they care about larger concepts like climate change that are really hard to get your head around. But if you take care of the bees, if you start looking at your own impact, it actually will connect very nicely into these larger issues, because you're going to be experiencing and creating landscapes that are healthier. For example, if you plant the roadsides in America with native plants, you're going to reduce mowing. That reduces greenhouse gases.
Right.
That
right.
also makes a more beautiful highway. That also makes for something that is more drought tolerant. That also, by the way, makes for pollinator habitat. So we don't have to lead with pollinators all the time. We can lead with the things that are going to enrich our lives, but also help pollinators. So we have a number of things, as you said, on our website. One of them is the Highways Bee Act, which people can sign up and support this. And this is asking the Department of Transportation to go ahead and not mandate anything, but support those states that want to make their highways more beautiful and want to put these native plants that are going to support pollinators on the roadsides. That's not going to work in every situation. Sometimes it wouldn't be smart to put those plants there. But what we want is to open people's eyes to all these opportunities to make it better. And little by little, these are all adding up. And this is one of the reasons that we were just fortunate to have President Obama sign a presidential memorandum during Pollinator Week, which is one of our initiatives. And next year, Pollinator Week is going to be June 15th through the 21st. This year, for Pollinator Week, we had 45 governors who signed individual proclamations saying pollinators are important in our state, and we're going to pay attention to this, not just to how they affect our agriculture, but how they affect our quality of life. And the President of the United States, one of the most powerful offices in the planet, said, we're going to have every federal agency, committee, department, commission take a look at how they're managing their landscapes, how they're talking to their employees, how they're reaching out to their partners with respect to pollinators. And that, to me, is the most powerful conservation act in a strategic, coordinated way that's happened in the 21st century. It's fantastic.
Huge. It is fantastic. And, you know, I just have to say, it's bringing a big grin to my face, because I got to go to the White House for the First Lady's, it was called the Kids State dinner, even though it was a luncheon. And I told everybody when I came back, I got to see the first bees. I mean, we got to tour the garden. I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to see the first bees in the first garden. But it's pretty magnificent to see the excitement of the White House staff, cooking staff, about their absolute sheer delight in sharing all the things that are being grown in the White House lawn. And lots more acres could be developed if anybody's listening from there, because there's a lot of room.
Well, in actual fact, they are listening, and right now they are looking at every federal installation in the country and saying, what could we do? So this is going
How
to be
exciting.
Sweeping. This is going to be sweeping, and it's exactly what we need. We need these coordinated efforts that are on the ground, not just in the federal government, but in every state. And this is where I think there can be real leadership opportunities for people to say, we want to be smarter about how we manage our landscapes. Because we have to have multi-use landscapes now, and we have to have business involved. And that's also one of the tenets that we have. The environment and the economy cannot be at war with each other. We have to work together. It's too big a problem to spend all our time just fighting. We've got to see the benefit for both and make this real on the ground for everybody.
And it is so not political. I mean, emphasizing that over and over, it's about one in every three bites of food we take, which has nothing to do with how we vote. It matters that much. And just a little aside about the website again, I cannot rave about it enough, and everybody, pollinator.org. If you do go to your own zip code, and it was like I was running behind on prepping for the show because I did go down that rabbit hole. And for example, in the Arizona area that I live, someone who wrote this is really, whoever did it, not one person, I'm sure, but the hundreds of people that contributed, they really are funny. It's user-friendly, and it's like two surprises for me. It talked about flies. And it said, you know, it's hard to imagine. It says something like why one would want to attract flies, but they really play an important role. And the other one about Arizona, I don't know how many other places have bat night, but in Tucson, Arizona, we have bat night because there's a huge concentration of bats under one of our bridges, and people start lining up hours before with their chairs to watch the bats come out. It's pretty amazing. But they're big.
Well, and they're big. They're very, not
huge.
All bats are pollinators, fruit bats mostly, but they do pollinate the agave. They bring us tequila if you want to have what's in it for me. But all bats are very useful, very, very useful in that they do consume so many more pounds than their own weight of pests every night. And yes, Arizona, Texas, the places in the Southwest that have these wonderful bats and have embraced them, it's a really, really smart thing to do. And when you get off the airplane in Austin, Texas, the first thing you see are murals, really accomplished murals heralding the bat and how important and how proud they are. So I think that's a hopeful thing for me. People are, they're putting their fears aside. They're saying, wait a minute, this is my partner. This isn't my enemy. This isn't something I want to squish or have some sort of an enemy that I make. This is something that I need, and I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to do it. I'm not going to expect somebody else, and I'm not going to rail against other people. I'm actually going to look at what I can do to make it better. So I think it's thrilling that you've got that same kind of energy in Arizona.
And thinking about how you're presenting this, it's not something that should be on your to-do list. It should be something on your, this is really exciting, it'll be beautiful, I'll be contributing, and it's about hope and being a part of the change. I mean, to me, it's like, it's not a heavy mandate. It's like, go plant some, you know, flowers or bushes or whatever that are going to be a part of helping for your community to be more sustainable. It's a no-brainer to me. It's like it brings delight to my very being.
So, well, and I think people need delight. And I do advocate that people go out sometime in the middle of the day. And when the flowers are in bloom take a look. Just pause. Don't bring your handheld device with you. Just sit there and experience what's happening in the garden.
Yeah, and don't make it a photo op.
No. If you have a quiet garden and if you do not see any activity, that's when you should be worried. It isn't when you see a bee, oh, I'm frightened. It's when you don't see a bee, when the conditions are right, and you don't see any life in that. That's when you have to ask yourself a question. What's wrong with this picture?
What's going on, and why is it so quiet in here? And, Lori, we're going to have to take another quick break, and when we come back,
great,
I'd like to talk about a little bit more about the pollinator partnership, who's involved, who's on board, and then let's talk about, is there a bad guy, a smoking gun, or let's dispel that myth. Everybody stay here with me.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
You already know the Habit Store has cabinets, appliances, and paint, but did you know that we have contemporary and vintage furnishings? You might find a gorgeous new sofa offered at 50% off retail price or an antique mahogany dresser priced to sell. You might also find some great weekly specials on the Red Tag Sale. Keep up with the bargains through Facebook, Twitter, and our monthly newsletter. The Habit Store hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturdays, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road, just off I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, and I am actually listening too, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Our guest today is Lori Davies Adams, and she is the executive director of the Pollinator Partnership, the largest organization in the world dedicated exclusively to the protection and promotion of pollinators and their ecosystems. And just a little shout out about Mrs. Green's World Membership Program. It's alive and growing. Thank to all of you who stepped up. We ask that you become an official supporter of Mrs. Green's World and it'll help keep our broadcast free and independent. It's very easy to become a member by visiting our website at MrsGreensWorld.com. Click on the Preserve Our Planet icon, and you're there. And we would love to have you be a part of making this big message that we have, this big yes we've said to grow and expand and bring great shows like this to you. So everybody, Lori Davies Adams, can we talk a little bit about the partnership? I mean, you're managing I was trying to find a better analogy than a ship, because we're not really talking about it. But you really have a lot of players in terms of the partnership. You have, you know, everything from local, regional, national governments, corporations, universities, and others working to help with pollinator protection. What are some of the things that you're actually doing, and how do you work together to collaborate on important issues, especially ones that might be regional specific? And I know, Lori, that was a long question, but it was like, you get it. You get the idea. It's huge.
I think the thing that is really the hallmark of what we do is partnerships. We, as I said, don't vilify people. We want to engage. We want to engage the farmer. We want to engage the businessman and the businesswoman. We want to engage the educator, faith-based communities. There isn't anybody that we don't think of when we think of this issue, because everybody eats. And
exactly.
Everybody has influence over this. So partnerships are a big part of what we do. And you mentioned earlier the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign, and that is an organization we founded very early. We have about 120 different organizations that are a part of it, everything from universities and beekeeping groups and educators to government agencies. We have relationships with all of the federal agencies in the United States, but we're building now more in Canada and Mexico. We also have business at the table, and we try to get everybody to find that portion of this issue that they can all agree on and that we can all move ahead on. So we spend a lot of time on things that can be done rather than arguing to try to make one another perfect in the other guy's eyes. So the idea is we take people where they are and we help them move a little bit further and a little bit further. So it's the power of the possible. It's actually making incremental change. And, you know, when you look back over 20 years, it adds up to a very big change.
Significant.
So our style is not what you might hear from every environmental group, because we bring everybody to the party, and we say, all right, what can you do? What will you do? And we're a little tough on people, actually, because we don't use this as a platform for somebody to campaign about their perspective, their particular hot button. We say, that's fine. What can we all do? And we've had remarkable success as a result, because a lot of this is going to be very difficult. It's going to be very complex. And if we aim for perfection, we're going to just have an endless shouting match.
Right.
That, and we don't have time for that. We actually have to move ahead. And you'd be really surprised at how much you can accomplish. First of all, if you don't try to take all the credit for it, but also if you let people come up with the idea themselves and you say, here's what we're trying to do. How can you help? And so these 120 organizations have worked very hard. They're all divided into task forces, and they work on everything from, there was a stamp series that we got done about, I'd say 9 years ago. It was a series of stamps on pollination. And the U.S. Postal Service gets 55,000 requests a year postal stamp ideas.
Please make a stamp out of this.
That's right. But we worked it, and we called every member of Congress, and we made sure that they wrote letters, and we made sure that people understood that this is a neutral issue. It's just a small part of what we do. It's symbolic in many ways, but you'd be surprised. Once people get started on something, they go a little deeper than you think, and then you help them a little bit further. For example, when we called in the Senate, I personally called every agriculture LA, is what they call them in the Senate, and virtually all of them said, are you talking about honey? And then we had a wonderful conversation. Well,
right.
Honey's a small part of this, but it's, we want to talk to you about the whole part of it. And then by the end of the conversation, I wasn't asking for money or for them to do anything other than write a letter about a stamp. But we had had a conversation about an issue that they had heretofore not even thought about. Well, fast forward now, we're 9 years later, 45 governors each signed their own proclamations saying this is important. So these conversations can lead to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And for your listeners, I think there's so much that they can do. They can engage, as you said, on the website. They can get the recipe book for what they need to do. They can. We have organizations they can join. We have the Pollinator Action Team, where we give you alerts on things. We have a Bee Smart School Garden Kit. We have free curricula on our website as well, where you can help with a 4-H program or a scout program that you may be involved in. Or a church group program. We have all the tools available for people to do whatever they can. We also, for businesses, have something called Business for Bees, which includes very large multinational corporations like General Mills, Toyota, Boeing, big companies that you wouldn't think, why are they involved in pollinator work? They're involved because it actually fits into their corporate sustainability to help the environment keep their employees healthy, keep their raw materials coming. So every level of this, and you mentioned states, I think states are a marvelous opportunity. The departments of natural resources, the state departments of agriculture, there are great opportunities for landscapes that we really need. This is not something that is an extra. We need them now. So getting people involved at the state level is huge, and we have all the tools, again, on our website.
And it's really, like you said, the common ground. It starts with something as simple as everybody eats. And some of the most riveting pictures that I've seen are the ones that show what your grocery, you know, the produce section looks like with bees and what it looks like without them. I mean, and it is specific to bees. And you're like, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, we've got to get on this train because it has left the station. And a perfect...
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, outside of the produce department, one half of the world's oils come from pollinated plants. So this is all around us.
It's
and
big.
It's very interesting. Once you open people's eyes, they start to say, wow, yeah, you know, I haven't seen many insects in my garden for a while. I haven't seen any bees. Or, boy, I hadn't realized how important those particular foods are to my health, or I hadn't realized how easy it would be for me to switch out this part of my garden to be a natural habitat. It is easy, and we ask people to take the step that they can take. And for some people, it's, you know, join Mrs. Green's membership.
Yeah, I like that one.
It may be donate to the Pollinator Partnership. It may be to just lift a shovel and dig in the dirt, but it may also be to go to that farmer's market and buy locally produced honey, or to buy organic and locally produced foods, because that supports a system that's really trying to make things different. So
become
everybody
a part
can
of
do
a community
something.
Garden. I mean, we have such a proliferation of community gardens here. Or be part of, if you don't have kids in school, they need volunteers to help with the habitats that they are creating and someone to feed the chickens on the weekends and all of that. There's just something that's going to fulfill a desire in you to be a part of giving back. So when you talked about other big picture issues, where do the pollinators fit into the big picture of conservation? You know, there's water issues, and we talked a little bit. I have to say, Gary Nabhan, it's like he is like the best, and he's working so hard on the drought resistance crops for the Southwest, and it does fit in. Water is such a big issue,
right.
You know, CO2 emissions. But what about the pollinators? Where do they fit into the big picture?
Well, you know what's interesting? You in Arizona have two of the real, I would have to say, the champions of the pollinator issue, and that's Gary Nabhan and Steve Buckman, who wrote The Forgotten Pollinators. They wrote it 20 years ago, and that was the real start of this, because heretofore, people were entomologists who really just studied the plant-pollinator interactions. They didn't really think, what's happening to the population of these pollinators overall?
Right.
And they were the first ones to really bring that to everyone's attention. But in addition to that, you asked about how do these fit into the big picture of the environment. There are digger bees that aerate the soil as they're making their nests. There are bees that are pollinating the plants that are holding the hillsides, holding the shoreline of really areas that are now being inundated by new flooding or by new droughts. The whole situation of extreme climate conditions, first of all, they hit pollinators very hard.
Right.
Because pollinators are timed, their emergence is timed to the emergence of the plant life that is their sustenance. That's out of sync. And so their ranges are changing, and their needs are changing, and they can't, like humans, adapt exactly the same way. They have to do some adaptation, but some are going to suffer the consequences. So climate change affects them. So if you want to, turn out a light for a pollinator, or reduce your impact and walk to the store for a pollinator.
Right.
All of these actions, your imprint, your carbon footprint actually is affecting all of the animal life that supports you. So looking at our own impact is a huge part of this, and if we can tie it to pollinators, I'm perfectly happy with that because it gets you the same result. What we want is people to start to pay attention. And again, you don't want it to be punitive. You don't want people to be made to feel bad. What we want is people to feel good
and excited
about what they're doing. And excited.
Excited.
Because this is something you can do something about. You can make a difference, and you will see the difference.
And it's just, I mean, it's all about quality of life to me. And you really do such a wonderful job of articulating the fragileness of our ecosystem. I mean, one thing can be such a devastating, have such a devastating impact. And let's just talk for a minute because we don't have that much time left. But I'd love to cover this one about people love sometimes to find the smoking gun, the big bad wolf, and if we just do this, that problem's going to go away. Frequently, in this case, it's pesticides. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's a really tough issue because there are a lot of people for whom pesticides are just the worst thing that's ever happened to humanity. And there are others that say, wait a minute, these are tools. These are things that if I were growing food for my living, I would need. If I were trying to make my garden a certain way, I would need. So somewhere in the middle is a balance. And balance is actually a pretty good path in nature, too. So we look at the pesticide issue as a responsibility. And I think I mentioned before, when you have a chemical that you're going to apply, it's a real responsibility. We don't go after a particular class of pesticides. The neonicotinoids right now are getting a lot of attention, but if you look at some of the studies that have come out, there have been 134 different chemicals found in the CCD beehives. On average, the bees had 4.3 different chemicals. One hive alone had 32 different chemicals in it. And these aren't just pesticides that are insecticides. They're herbicides. They're combinations of fungicides and insecticides.
It's complicated.
So if we go about this by trying to vilify a certain class or making farmers feel that we don't really care at all about the fact that they're also raising food, I don't know how much progress we're going to make. Now, there are those who say the evidence is already in. There are those who say the evidence is exaggerated. We take a balanced view that says if we replace one pesticide with another chemical and we haven't learned the behavior, we're not going to see any change. And what we need is for people to change their behaviors. And that's a really tough thing to do. It's a lot easier for everybody to just point a finger. We need everybody to feel like, I can do this, and we need to show them how to do it, and we need to encourage them and incentivize them to do the right thing. So that's the approach that we take to it. It's a tough one because I think we have lost sight of how powerful these chemicals are. There are still a lot of really strange things that people do that if you analyze them or if you even point it out, they would say, oh, yeah, well, I don't know. I shouldn't be doing that, should I? They just haven't taken the time to think it through. So one of the things that we've done is create training for pesticide applicators, for farmers, for people who apply pesticides for a living, because most of them have not been exposed to what they can do to reduce or eliminate the impact. And that's where we're starting.
The solution and the education. I mean, it's such a great note on which to end the show, which to me, time flies when you're having fun. And we were really, I just have to say this, really buzzing about. It was just absolutely and positively delightful. And I want to make sure that everybody hears your message about, instead of focusing on that, focus on go out and plant a bush, plant a tree, plant a garden, you are amazing. It's been a great show. You're a great guest, and thanks for what you're doing to the planet. Everybody, thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. Two great shows coming up next week, our Down to Earth series on the important role nonprofits play in sustainable communities. And next Saturday, Frank Sesno, director of the George Washington University School of Media and Public Affairs and creator and host of Planet Forward. Lori Davies Adams, thank you. Make it a great green week, everybody.